From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Hello, welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel.
They call me Ben. We are joined, as always, with our super producer, Paul Mission Control Deccant. Most importantly, you are you, you are here, and that makes this Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. If you are watching this on video, please pay no attention to the skeleton slowly getting closer and closer to the camera. On my end, we've decided to just let that one ride. Surely nothing weird will happen. But speaking of weird things, today's question: are you one of the people who's heard an inexplicable bump in the night? Have you felt a sharp thump or a pinch against your back, only to turn around and find the room behind you is empty? For people who believe in ghosts, or for any fan of horror movies in general, today's subject will be familiar. We are exploring the concept known as the poltergeist. So here are the facts. For a lot of us in the West, the term poltergeist is most often associated with a fictional film with the same name, Poltergeist. In that film, there's a normal everyday family in California with the unfortunate surname of Freeling, the Freeling family. It's a good script, but they fall victim to a malevolent spirit or spirits that at first seem playful and friendly. They communicate with the kids through a television screen, but eventually, of course, they turn sinister. The youngest daughter of the household disappears. This prompts her parents, increasingly desperate, to seek help from a parapsychologist and an exorcist. And, you know, without debating whether or not Poltergeist is a horror film instead of a horror-themed family film, it's only rated PG, by the way, we can say this is probably one of the things that people most associate the idea of poltergeist activity with. Yeah.
Wasn't there a line about a poltergeist in the first Ghostbusters movie? Mm-hmm. Doesn't he equate one of the ghost sightings to being a poltergeist?
Yeah, that's correct. And we also see poltergeist activity in Ghostbusters. Remember, in the library, books are flying off the shelves, right? So that's a hallmark of what is often portrayed as poltergeist activity. It's weird because collectively, all the stuff we call poltergeist activity is a real thing in that there are numerous cases of purported activity throughout history. So there are real reports. The question is, what exactly are people reporting?
Yeah, exactly. And by the way, Poltergeist 2 is the one that gave me nightmares as a kid. So if you're in the mood for a movie that might actually scare you, I'd recommend that one.
I'll tell you what gave me nightmares, that lady with the really creepy little baby voice. Was she the exorcist or the parapsychologist? I can't remember.
Exorcist.
Yeah, that's right.
This house is clear.
Mm-hmm. Very creepy.
Yeah. I think she's probably one of the most captivating parts of that. And Matt, is Poltergeist 2 the one with the scene of the evil animated braces?
I believe that's the one, and the one with the meat. There's like some scene with meat that I remember watching in my cousin's house, and from then on it was over. Like, I couldn't look at steak the same way.
I have a real soft spot in my heart for stop motion meat. There's a great stop motion meat scene in that Peter Jackson movie, Dead Alive, also known as Brain Dead. There's like a piece of meat that's like kind of adorable. There's a part where it's looking at itself in the mirror and like preening, like, oh, look at me, I'm a beautiful piece of meat. And then there's also obviously the films of Jan Svankmajer. He animates meat a lot as well. So I actually find that stuff delightful. I haven't seen part two, though. I'll have to check it out. I just remember the creepy clown from one.
Speaking of meat, we have an artist in our audience who does these like photorealistic paintings of meat. I've got a Actually, I have one of those hanging up in the house. I'll put it up here when I get this set together. But with Poltergeist, I think we can agree one of the other really compelling characters is the villain. No spoilers, but he's a really creepy guy who walks around. I remember being a kid and really catching his vibe when he goes to the doors of houses and he's like, "All are welcome. All are welcome." You guys may remember that. But they didn't make up the point of this is they didn't make up all the stuff that happens just in a brainstorming session in the writer's room. They were taking accounts of things that have been reported as real life events, and they didn't make up the word poltergeist either. It comes from the German language. It's a combination of two words, poltern, making sound to rumble, and geist, ghost or spirit. So it's not a huge plot twist that we would call a noisy spirit a poltergeist, especially if we were German.
The phrase does go back a long time, right? 1800s, I believe, in Germany, 1838, something around then. Mm-hmm. But it's not just Germany. That wasn't the only place. Just because they came up with the name doesn't mean they're the only ones experiencing something like this. In a lot of places, there are other invisible entities that aren't necessarily spirits or ghosts that have the power to, in some way, manifest in the corporeal world, move things, push people, interact with us and objects. There's a wealth of historical tales, even if they're not true, or perhaps you don't believe that they're true stories. There are so many tales throughout time about this kind of activity.
Yeah, collectively known as ghost lore instead of folklore sometimes, which I think is just chef's kiss. So to your point, Matt, there might be cases in merry old England that were blamed on a bogart instead of a poltergeist. But if you look at what's happening or what's being reported to have happened, the activities are very much the same. That means that a lot of people throughout time and throughout the geography of the world have been reporting similar things under a different name. So the term poltergeist is an umbrella label that we're using to describe any number of things. And for the true believers, a poltergeist can be best understood as sort of a genre of a ghost, a type of entity or spirit, or it can also be understood as just that set of activities or abilities attributed to these kinds of things.
I mean, if you wanted to assign like a personality to a poltergeist, it's kind of the gremlin of the ghost world, right? Because it's like, you know, its activities can range from the mischievous, like we said in Poltergeist the movie, where it's like stacking chairs or, you know, making books flutter around like in Ghostbusters, or a little bit more devious, but they're not your exorcist level demonic power. You know what I mean? They tend to be a little more innocuous. But we have examples where things go a little further than that. So it is a genre, like you said, kind of a wide swath of ghostly attributes.
Yeah, and we did talk about how generally whatever this entity is purported to be, it is invisible to most observers. Now, if not all observers, it's either invisible or mostly invisible.
Mm-hmm. And you might hear it speak in some cases, usually to say some like cryptic, epic, threatening stuff. Very rarely to say like, hey, sorry, I didn't know that was the good China that I busted. Mm-hmm. But we see in the cases where we see poltergeists specifically portrayed or described as entities, we also see several common threads. First, the big one, the one we've already talked about a little bit, the movement of objects by some undetermined means. Cutlery flying through the air, the good
dangerous
China. Yeah, falling out of the hutch, furniture being overturned, books zooming off shelves, mirrors cracking, windows, doors slamming open, then shut. Psychokinesis, maybe, but the best way to describe it right now in the episode is movement of objects by undetermined means. That's the first thread, but there are two other really big ones.
Right. I mean, we often see these events centered around a person, a haunted individual that is being visited by this, somewhat malevolent spirit. And often, but not always, it's an adolescent girl, which is interesting.
Yeah. And we'll probably talk about this later in the episode, but the concept of puberty, and in the female body specifically, appears to be something that has been looked at before, like through actual scientific means. It feels a little sketchy, but we'll talk about it a little later.
It's dodgy for sure, yeah. Right? And that's part of our exploration today hinges on that aspect, because it is relatively unusual in the world of ghost lore to have a specific person being haunted fitting that, like, because of that demographic. There's a question of causation that's tremendously important. The third big thread in this ghost lore is that the poltergeist usually isn't just messing around. It has an aim, a motivation, a cause. In the fictional film Poltergeist, promised last time we'll bring it up, the antagonistic spirit, the all are welcome character, wants to kidnap the youngest daughter of the, again, unfortunately named Freeling family, because it will be able to gain power by consuming her light. And this is heavily implied to be something innate to her, possibly at this time in her life. Although she's younger, she's like 8 years old. It's heavily implied that it might also be like some kind of Shining-esque nascent psychic powers. There's something special about her. But with those three common threats, with the idea of telekinesis, psychokinesis, or moving objects, the idea of a certain type of person being haunted, and the idea of the ghost or spirit or entity having an aim, we can see examples of poltergeist, or I should say examples of poltergeist stories, reported as fact throughout history. Like, we could, there is probably a podcast that examines each one of these in the canon, and that podcast could be entirely dedicated to it. But we wanted to give you a few examples of poltergeist stories, some you may have heard of before, some you may have not.
That's great. And we can start out with a haunting, a purported haunting that occurred in Tennessee. It's known as the Bell Witch of Tennessee. Now, it's quite old. It's quite a bit older than a lot of the ones we'll be talking about. This one originates in the 1800s, between 1817 and 1821. And here's the gist of the story. There's a family there in Tennessee. The father, or the head of the household, his name is John Bell Sr. And the entire house, everybody living in it, begins to experience strange stuff. There's some entity that they think is an entity, at least, that has the ability to speak to them, like directly to them, while they're in the house, that is not a member of the family, just somebody else, some disjointed voice that talks to them. And it's also able to do things that we've described earlier in a lot of these commonalities. It's moving things. It's throwing things. It's able to affect the physical environment. And it's able to, they think, shapeshift into other things that they will then see maybe around the house, maybe even within the house, but they are attributing all of these sightings to the same one thing, the same entity.
Yeah. And this story is one of the most famous accounts of poltergeist activity in the US. You have probably heard something about it. You've probably also, perhaps unknowingly, seen some piece of fiction based on this. The verdict here, organize these by like time, place, gist, verdict. So the verdict here is that there is a huge problem with any research into this story. The huge problem is this: the first printed account, called the Authenticated History of the Bell Witch, was published in 1894. That's 75 years after these events occurred. And for this reason, the Authenticated History of the Bell Witch is often treated as a work of historical fiction. Our modern understanding of whatever the facts may be is inevitably tainted by all the embellishments that occurred, in the almost centuries worth of time before something happened and after it got written about.
And taking into account all the embellishments that have occurred since it was published in 2020. Because there are videos, you can find videos online right now, really pretty recent videos that claim a lot of things about the Bellwitch.
And there's an important part of time here, too, when we talk about our observations. You'll notice that there's a sort of glory days of poltergeist reporting, and it drops off around the time that we entered into the glory days of the technological revolution. So when we hear stories about the Bellwitch, even if we go to the closest primary source we can find, we're still almost a century away from what happened. So it's just very difficult to know what is true, what is not. So that's one example. And we're not saying nothing weird happened. We're saying it is almost impossible to figure out of the things that are reported, which are factual and which are later rumors people added because it made them sound cool at the general store or at the local saloon.
Next, we have what's collectively referred to as the Great Amherst Mystery that took place in Nova Scotia, Canada. There's another Canadian, pretty famous Canadian poltergeist story called the Chilliwack Poltergeist. I only say that because I did a podcast about this part of Canada once and I pronounced it Chilliwack and I got yelled at. So Chilliwack. This one, though, is in Nova Scotia, Canada, that took place between 1878 and 1879. An 18-year-old female by the name of Esther Cox lived with her sister's family and was the victim of an attempted sexual assault. Shortly after that took place, there came a series of knocks, bangs, rustles, and all sorts of other, again, like these noises that are associated, the whole idea of the ghost, what is it, the noisy ghost or the ghost clang, as the name translates to in German. These noises were plaguing the household, keeping people up all night. Esther started having seizures. Parts of her bodies would swell. And this is kind of the escalation we're talking about. She was simultaneously feverish and then would get chills at various different times. And objects in the house would appear to fly around of their own volition. And visitors came over the next few months. They left with the pretty serious impression that this was actually happening, that there was a poltergeist at work. This would have been a phenomenon that would have been familiar to folks in those days because of that lore and things like the Bellwitch.
And a lot of contemporaneous investigators believed this to be a series of supernatural events. But there are later things in the chronology that prove this might not be the case entirely. For a time, Esther Cox fell ill with diphtheria, and when she was confined to her bed for about 2 weeks, I believe, the activity ceased entirely. This is one of the reasons that later investigators, like Walter F. Prince in 1919, built a pretty compelling case for trickery on the part of Esther Cox. However, he was quick to say he thought this occurred while in a disassociative state. So that would mean that Cox herself was not like actively trying to make things worse. And she got locked up for arson later in life. She only served 1 month out of four. And when she came back after that month in prison, the events ceased entirely. She got married twice. She lived a normal life until passing away at the age of 52. So there are weird things that happened in her life that seem to coincide with drop-offs in the ghost activity. There was also not activity during that month she was in prison.
Interesting. If you blast a little bit later in history, 1967, you've got another one that has some similar hallmarks. In a lawyer's office in Rosenheim, Germany, there were a very similar series of occurrences that revolved around a 19-year-old secretary named Anne-Marie Chabery. Things like lights flickering and paintings, you know, going crooked and falling off the walls. And, you know, when the fluorescent tubes were unscrewed, there would be like massive arcs, electrical spikes and furniture moving, things like that. And it was investigated and they called in physicists and parapsychologists by the name of Hans Bender. And he investigated and couldn't figure it out. But it was kind of believed pretty widely that this was a hoax. There were apparently hidden nylon threads found, and similar to the previous story, Ben, the incidents stopped when this the secretary left the employ of the firm in 1968.
It's weird because if you believe that something is actually happening, the leaving of somebody or the removing of someone from a situation may make you believe or may make you think that the haunting is attached to that person. So when they leave, no more haunting.
Yeah, but poltergeist haunts a person, not a place, right? That's one of the assumptions.
But if you're skeptical, well, obviously it stopped when that person is gone. Similar to a crime being committed or something like a serial killer being caught. Once you put away that person, there's no more killings.
It is problematic, though, because, you know, a lot of the kind of debunking of these things revolve around, you know what? Kids like attention. And kids like to, you know, maybe some with a little bit more of a sociopathic desire for attention could possibly go to some great lengths to say, look at me, you know, and get that desired attention. And so, but it's interesting because it's a revolved around a person, when that person leaves, it goes away. And so it's very easy to kind of like get those things mashed up together, you know, which is it?
Well, and there's also... there's something to talk about here about the length of time of a haunting, how long something actually lasts, because we've seen here already in what we've been talking about that these can go on for years, or in the case of the events that Noel, you already mentioned here earlier, the Chilliwack poltergeist in Canada, it only went on for, I think, 2 months, right?
And that's another thing that's associated with these poltergeist occurrences. They're typically pretty short. They're not years. They're usually, you know, 3 or 4 months, maybe 5 months max, which still seems like an awful long time to be tortured by a restless spirit. But yeah, this was from, I think, 2 months between 51 and 52. And it's just the same kind of stuff. Loud sounds, bangings on the wall, flying objects and the like. And then there's another case around the same time, the Brother Dolly case, where you had stains, which is a new one, carvings of images and words in Welsh language of a religious nature, to your point, Ben, of that cryptic kind of vaguely religious language. And this one took place for multiple years.
Yeah. So these commonalities should not be considered hard constraints. There are always going to be things that occur on the edges. Again, there are many examples. One thing I love about them is their odd, fascinating names. The marketing is wonderful. You've got the drummer of Tedworth, the black monk of Pontefract, and the Seaford poltergeist, and so on and so on. But I want to explore that one common thread that I was saving till now, which is, simply put, kids crave attention. So many parents in our audience today likely recognize this idea. Kids want attention, right? Sometimes they'll do weird things. Sometimes they'll do things they know they're not supposed to do. Sometimes they'll do pranks, even inappropriate behavior, to get some eyes on them.
Just so you know, my son, while we were recording this, he's come in like 3 times. You probably haven't seen it or heard it, hopefully, because Paul is doing his job very, very well. But Ben and Noel have probably seen him come in, and I'm having to mute and look at him. And it's just because it needs attention right now. And he knows that I'm doing something.
And he's great at it, though. Like, he's a charmer.
He's an attention ninja. I love it. Well, also earlier, though, like there was like this very ghostly, plaintive little piano line wafting in the background. I'm like, what is this ghostly piano? Like, oh, that's the boy. No more piano playing while Dad's recording. Damn you!
I think he plays piano pretty well too.
It was
by the
awesome.
Way. Just to point that
some
out.
Some Nine Inch Nails or something. It was super spooky.
So this idea, right, which is something clearly we in the show can identify with, and clearly something you listening can identify with. This is a common thing, and it's part of the reason that more skeptical investigators, people like Joe Nickel with two L's, will argue that poltergeist activities are typically caused by what he describes as an individual motivated to cause mischief. So there is someone haunting the house and throwing things, and they do have a mission, and they just happen to be human rather than otherworldly.
Right.
He said he notes that this is something Matt, you and I were talking about off air. He notes that a lot of these seemingly telekinetic events, when you look at the facts of the case, the placement of the people and the things, a lot of these things are events that could easily be accomplished by a kid who's out to like plague their somewhat gullible parents. And then, of course, when things are told and retold and embellished, maybe there are some parents or people in authority who don't want to say, well, it turned out my 9-year-old had figured out like a pretty clever way to spook the shit out of me by knocking on, you know, the upstairs bathroom floor at 3 a.m. And then so instead I'm going to embellish it. And I'm going to say, you know, it went away when I prayed, not when my kid went back to, you know, their grandparents yeah. for the summer. And that's how you end up with strange stories of like Andrew Jackson visiting the Bell Witch before he became president. It's a great yarn. It's also completely untrue.
I love it.
So that's why we see this idea. Now, unless lest anybody think that we're being discriminatory against children, who are obviously awesome, we have to note that in numerous cases, competent investigators found activities purported to be poltergeist provably hoaxes perpetrated by children, such as the famous Fox sisters. And proving that those things were hoaxes did nothing to stem the popularity of the story.
Of course,
people
not.
Loved it.
People don't want the truth. People want a cool story. People want like something that captivates their imagination. The truth is always way less interesting. You know, it makes me think some of these parents probably deserved it. You guys, they were probably awful parents and they needed to have a good lesson taught to them, like in Matilda, where she like, you know, gradually files off the bottom of her father's shoes or something like that to make him think he's getting shorter, or hems his pants, does something weird like that, but super covertly and over a long period of time to make him think he's losing his mind. That, you know, and they were horrible parents. I mean, I know it's just a story, but you know, that stuff holds true.
Yeah, the reality is, it appears that in several of these cases, there has been something terrible going on. Or the one we just mentioned, was it Amherst with Esther Cox? Yeah, I mean, sexual assault was involved. There was trauma, and there was a need for something, right? But that she needed something. It appears that way, at least, and it was probably attention and care, and you know. It appeared there are several that we've looked at. One of them that occurs in Ohio, I think Columbus, Ohio, in 1984, that we can talk about maybe a little later, where there's the same kinds of thing happening there. There's somebody who is in great need, who is a child, who is looking for something that maybe they're not getting.
I deeply appreciate that point because it's something we had explored in our earlier look at exorcism. Specifically non-Western exorcism. There are socio-political factors inherent in this because all people are intelligent.
Even children.
Or have the potential to be so. Yeah, children are terrifyingly intelligent. They're brilliant. Until about puberty, I guess. But we see people who are traditionally left voiceless through one avenue or another in society finding innovative ways to make their voices heard. So it shouldn't be surprising that children who are often not listened to will do their level best to be heard. And just like in the case with non-Western exorcisms, many of the possessed are themselves children, or they are people identifying as women who are in societies that oppress women. So now it's not me voicing a problem, says the possessed. Or the haunted, now it is another entity, a powerful one, one that society must pay heed to. There's a very interesting sociological argument there, but what gives, you might be saying, are you all out here to ruin my Wednesday or Friday by telling me that all poltergeists are hoaxes? Are they just misunderstandings of mundane phenomenon? Could there be any real provable sand to at least some of the stories?
God, I hope not.
Maybe.
We'll tell you after a word from our sponsor. Q here's where it gets crazy.
So, I mean, you know, we've spent the first part of this episode kind of debunking as we go a little bit. And indeed, there are hoaxes aplenty in the world of poltergeist, just like there are in the world of psychics and mediums and all of that. There's a lot of pageantry involved. I'm fascinated by the angle of children being kind of forgotten and mistreated and using this kind of behavior as a way of acting out or, you know, giving themselves a voice. But while the vast majority of the events paranormal researchers tout as solid proof of poltergeists are often pretty readily dismissed by academics and skeptics, science does have some interesting ideas about what might actually be happening to folks who would be unfortunate enough to be actual victims of some sort of antagonistic supernatural force. So poltergeists as a natural phenomenon is super unsettling. Is it a figment of the mind or something more?
Yeah, it's no secret that scientists have for a long time, if we want to be polite, we will say scientists have for a long time suspected that ghosts are an illusion, or they're a cultural lens through which we interpret other events. There are a series of sensations maybe created in the mind of us as observers. This is compounded by the fact that patients who suffer from specific types of neurological or psychological conditions often have reported strange presences around them, hearing voices, right, from no discernible source. This is not just something that happens through the lens of mental illness as we now understand it. This is also probably... neurology probably plays a huge part in the role of historical prophets, visionaries, and saints, and so on. But dismissing every alleged case of a poltergeist haunting as the product of an unsound mind doesn't give due diligence to the events themselves. We never want to be that jerk in any horror movie or story who says, "It's only the wind." And someone's like, "I'm bleeding out of my eyes." That's the wind. It looks like blood because it's in your eyes. We don't want to be those people.
Yeah, we don't. And we also don't want to be those people that, you know, believe that because someone is experiencing something like that, that, I don't know, I have problems with thinking about it as an unsound mind, right? I do wonder sometimes if there is something more to that connection beyond, you know, to maybe seeing someone or hearing the voice of a muse or someone like that that isn't truly there. I wonder, we would say it's an unsound mind because it's not a nominally functioning mind, right? It doesn't, that person doesn't experience the world the way that many of us do.
Sure.
But I think there's something special to that experience.
Yeah, there's a profound link, isn't there? We don't understand the brain fully. We don't really understand the creative process, not 100%. And we also, I don't know, I agree. I think it is dismissive to immediately say, it's the same thing as saying you're crazy. And honestly, honestly, the way we use normal for most conversational descriptions of this stuff, that's borderline ridiculous. Normalcy in that sense is a myth and never really existed. It's as made up as some of the more skeptical folks might think ghosts are. But the point of this is to what you're saying, Matt, if we dismiss any kind of description like this automatically as the product of a quote-unquote unsound mind, then we are not exercising critical thinking and we are not conducting good science. And maybe more importantly, we're not helping a person who is convinced that something is making their life horrific. So we have to look at the studies. And luckily, there are studies about this. There's one really interesting one we found that happened because some people in Switzerland got together and they wanted to see whether they could recreate the experience of being physically touched by a ghost. Not only whether they could recreate it, but whether they could provably reproduce it multiple times. And the crazy thing is, they did.
Yeah, I mean, I believe that two of the volunteers got so freaked out that they like peaced out and were like, "I'm done with this." And it's really interesting the way they set up this experiment. They actually used robotics, and they allowed 12 volunteers to control the movement of this like jointed robot arm using their index fingers. And the first set of volunteers were blindfolded, and those movements rather were relayed to another robotic arm, which would touch the volunteer's back. I'm assuming, obviously it would be in pure darkness since they're blindfolded. When both the finger pushing and the back touching occurred at the same time, it created a compelling illusion. I'm trying to picture this. So it's another individual touching the device, and then it's syncing up with another device. I'm a little bit, go ahead, Matt.
I'll paint a picture for you. Imagine you're standing in a room, you got your blindfold on, right in front of you, where, like, at arm's reach, there is a device that you can control right here, right?
Doing it.
Right immediately behind you, there is a robot that's on a shelf. And it's got an arm that can extend out and come back. And all you're doing is manipulating what's in front of you. And then in real time, the way you would with a video game controller, that robot is touching your back as you are telling it to touch your back.
They were not aware of this robotic arm at the back, though.
That's... Yes, exactly. They just thought they were manipulating this thing in front of them. So when it was working like that in real time, it gave the volunteers the sensation that they were touching their own backs somehow, because it was in sync. But the weird stuff occurs when they gave the pushing of the button and then the actual action of touching the back. They gave it a delay of about 500 milliseconds.
Very slight delay, right? Just ever so slightly off, just a little bit of kind of a tactile uncanny valley.
That makes sense.
Vibe, yep, is how I would describe it. And so when this happened, suddenly the volunteers did not feel this like I'm unsettlingly touching my own back somehow. They felt that they were being touched by something else, something inhuman, by a ghostly presence. And then they also additionally, again, just because of that delay, had the feeling that they were being watched. They reported that they felt as though they were drifting backwards toward this unseen ghostly hand, which means their proprioception, your sense of your body in space, was being fundamentally influenced. And then they also reported, on average, the strong sensation of two invisible presences standing very, 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 very close to them. Like when you know how if you put your hand close enough to the skin of someone with a fever, you can feel the warmth, right? So something like that. And several volunteers reported up to four presences. So a 500 millisecond delay made them think there was a gang of ghosts that was just sort of tapping them, doing whatever their robot hand was instructed to do. And two volunteers got, to use the scientific term, severely freaked out. It harshed their mellow, and they refused to continue the experiment. So the report argues that these sensations, these things we call ghosts, do not haunt the waking world. Instead, they haunt our brains. Mm-hmm.
No, that makes sense. And I mean, honestly, like as you were walking through these descriptions and I'm kind of closing my eyes and trying to picture this, I kind of started freaking myself out a little bit because it is a very strange, disfluent sensation to like be think you're in control of something and then introduce that lag and introduce that other element where, yeah, I could see how like if I was facing forward and I'm touching something that's in front of me and then all of a sudden I feel it, like the feedback loop of that is a little disconcerting. But then you introduce that delay, not to mention the sensory deprivation of just being blindfolded alone. That's probably a big part of it, too. I imagine if you did this in a purely sensory deprived environment, it would probably amplify those sensations a lot, because the feeling of moving backwards or the feeling of like being disjointed in space and time, a lot, you know, you can trick yourself into a lot of things just by closing your eyes really hard and seeing visual distortions and sunspots and all the little flashy things that happen. I could imagine this harnessed that pretty damn well. How do you come up with this? What a weird concept. What a weird experiment.
I guess they got a good deal on robot arms.
Yeah.
You know,
or they had some leftover from some other thing.
Yeah, exactly. They knew a guy. Also, if you want to experience, there are a lot of interesting hacks you can do to your own sense of proprioception. One thing for the gamers in the crowd, you can play a game called Mirror's Edge. It's a first-person POV parkour game. Matt, I think you and I may have talked about this years back when it came out.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's a really fun, strange game. In fact, you can just do virtual reality of any kind. In a lot of ways, you can experience some of that stuff.
True. Yeah.
Or, you know, just take a shower in the dark. That's what I do.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's weird that people shower with the lights on. You know what I mean?
Unrelated. Have you guys ever drank a beer in the shower? It's apparently a thing people love to do, and I did it for the first time the other week, and let me report back. It is a delightful little luxury. A shower beer. Just putting that out there. Unrelated. Please continue.
So, a co-author of this study, by the way, we would be remiss if we didn't mention the study came about in 2014. Led by a professor, Olag Blanke, and his co-author summed up their findings by saying the following, quote, "Our brain possesses several representations of our body in space. Under normal conditions, it is able to assemble a unified self-perception of the self from these representations. But when the system malfunctions because of disease, or in this case, a robot, this can sometimes create a second representation of one's own body, which is no longer perceived as me, but as someone else, a presence." So also shout out to Stuff You Should Know's, did they do that? They did an episode on that rare psychological condition where someone feels like their hand is not their own.
Yeah. Oh, what is that called? What is that called?
It's called ghost hand syndrome? Phantom hand.
Phantom hand.
I'm kidding. I don't know what the hell it's called. That sounds very unsettling, though. I don't like it one bit.
That was in the TV show. Were we on set for that episode?
I think we were. Yeah, the characters based on us play a role in that. Alien Hand Syndrome, I believe,
is the
name. And then there's Phantom Limb. But I like Phantom Hand. That also sounds like a cool martial arts move that you would see in a kung fu movie. But so there we have it. These feelings of presence, the researchers call them FOPs. These feelings of presence, again, through a cultural lens, are often interpreted as spirits, angels, demons, other supernatural creatures, because, you know, many of these reports occur before the rise of modern psychology or modern research into neurology. And we do have one last note that pertains to our earlier conversation about neurological disorders, because you see, before the researchers took these volunteers and subjected them to the terror of the unknown robot hand, they scanned the brains of people who had neurological disorders and had also encountered feelings of presence in the past.
That's right. And they identified disturbances within those brains in three specific regions: the insular cortex, the parietal frontal cortex, and the temporoparietal cortex. Now, that may mean nothing to you, as it does to me, a guy who doesn't know much about parts of the brain. But these sectors within all of our heads, we've all got these, they're involved in self-awareness, our understanding of where we are in space and time and who we are, what we are, in the sensations of movement, in creating movement within our bodies, and our sense overall of where we exist in physical space and time. So, kind of weird, right? Those are important things to just be able to function, right? Knowing where you are, what you are, and how to move about. So we're gonna continue down and find some things that are even spookier in this world of scientific research into what causes possibly poltergeists and other ghost encounters. But first, we're going to hear a word from our sponsor.
And we come to it. This is my favorite part. This is the weirdest, most out there part. This involves two Italian researchers, Piero Brovetto and Vera Maxia. They sought to explain the origin of poltergeist phenomena through the lens of what they would describe as a quantum mechanical vacuum. Let us pause and participate in the silent groans that every physicist in the audience just expelled. Here's the deal.
Did we tease this at the top, by the way?
Right, right. And this is, this is an argument familiar to people who perhaps delved into speculative science for characters like Carrie in the Stephen King novel and later film. These researchers argue that children during puberty undergo tremendous physiological changes, various parts of their bodies, including, of course, the brain. That's not controversial. That's something we can all agree on. Most of us listening to the show today have probably experienced puberty firsthand. If you have not, you're in for a wild ride.
Congratulations and sorry.
Yes, make the most of it.
Super fun.
So here's where these researchers' ideas take a sharp turn into fringe science. Brovetto and Maxia did not stop there. They argue that changes in the adolescent brain, particularly that of biological females, somehow involve fluctuations in electron activity, long story short, that can somehow create disturbances up to, quote, a few meters around the outside of the brain. And these disturbances, they say, would be similar in character to the quantum mechanical fluctuations that physicists believe occur in the vacuum, in which virtual particle and antiparticle pairs pop up for just a fleeting moment before they annihilate each other and disappear again.
And then it starts over, right? They just, something strange happens with those virtual and antiparticles. And they go on to say that within the pubescent brain, the extra fluctuations that are triggered because of that, what the brain is going through, they believe that the number of virtual particles surrounding the person is increased. Which again, like, I'm still wrapping my head around just the concept of virtual particles, but it's all good. The concept here is that it would slowly increase the presence of air around them.
I was just trying to Google virtual particles and it came up with virtual party ideas, which I guess is a product of COVID. Please, Matt, please continue. So sorry.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So increasing the number of virtual particles around a person, in theory, according to these guys, would also increase the air pressure surrounding them. And the thought is maybe the way the air pressure then is altered could make a physical object, a paper or something with very little mass, would be much easier to manipulate than maybe a telephone or something like that. But they're saying they could move an object potentially by changing this air pressure with their virtual particle pubescent brains.
And yeah, that if that is, you believe them, right?
Yeah.
Because think about the tremendous change in air pressure that would be needed to your point, Matt, move very heavy objects. Piece of paper? Maybe. Yeah, why not?
Slam a door?
Yeah. An Oxford English dictionary, right? Three very different objects in space. So as we previously established in earlier episodes, everything we know about the brain right now seems to indicate that this would be at the very least an implausible series of events. This paper was published, by the way, in the journal Neuroquantology. One note that I find hilarious, Brian Josephson, a Nobel laureate physicist who is on the editorial board of Neuroquantology, was contacted for his input about the paper. And while he was trying to be nice, he said, "It sounds distinctly flaky to me." At which point, reading this, I rolled my eyes and thought, editors. But you know, despite being a little tight on time here, this is all to prove that there is research happening in this field. We've got like a brief shout out toward the very end to one of my favorite hobby horses in this realm. But Noel, you wanted to tell us a little bit about the work of one Ian Stevenson, right?
Yeah, that's right. Only to kind of highlight the idea that, you know, we know from folks like Russell Targ, you know, who is a very renowned physicist who did work with MIT in their research labs, but then ultimately went on to focus his life's work on developing technology and methods for harnessing psychic abilities, something that the scientific community at large doesn't believe to be a thing. And this is a guy who comes from that world, and I'm always fascinated by, and it always gives a little more credence to some of these claims when you see people that kind of make that transition from the scientific to the more spiritual or fringy or what have you. So this is a good example of that. This guy, Ian Stevenson, he was a Canadian psychiatrist, Canadian-born psychiatrist, but did his work in the U.S. At the University of Virginia School of Medicine. He worked there for 50 years. He was the chair of the Department of Psychiatry from 1957 to 1967, and a Carlson Professor of Psychiatry from 1967 to 2001. And I happened upon him in preparing for this episode from a paper that he wrote in the Journal of American Society for Psychical Research. And this is from volume 66 from June of 1972. And the title of the work is, Are Poltergeists Living or Are They Dead? And the thing I liked about that is that it kind of presupposes that poltergeists are a real phenomenon. You know, it like launches in with that kind of preconceived understanding. And I appreciated that because it's not trying to debunk it. It's kind of trying to explain it a little bit and go through some examples that he found in his research, most of which took place in India. And it was a lot of the things we're talking about. There's one called The Case of Sisir Kumar, which he acknowledges had some problems in it because there was a long gap from when the events of the case actually occurred and then when they were recorded, largely by folks who didn't necessarily witness it. But he goes through and describes them very matter-of-factly, things like books flying off shelves and food disappearing and other, you know, some of these kind of run-of-the-mill poltergeist type activities. And a lot of his work wasn't so much focused on poltergeist. It was more focused on proving the existence of the afterlife. So didn't want to go too deep into him, but if anyone wants to read this paper, I definitely recommend it. It's you can find the full text of it as a PDF online, and it's called Are Poltergeists Living or Are They Dead? And just an interesting dude. I think he'd be good to dive into a little bit more. But there are examples of folks from the scientific community that do put some credence into this whole phenomenon. And then don't just think it's, you know, our mind playing tricks on us, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So these Italian researchers and then researchers like Stevenson. He also has some interesting work on reincarnation, which makes the same kind of assumption. It starts from the assumption that reincarnation exists and attempts to prove the process that it occurs through.
A cool thought experiment.
A cool thought experiment. A million percent. Yes.
But again, he gets shredded by a lot of colleagues. He's not, he is definitely has his critics.
And there's an elephant in the room that we have to address. We set up at the top. We said it's one of the most prominent, not your room, Matt. There's an elephant. There's an elephant in the room inside all of us, right?
In our hearts.
Elephants are amazing. Yeah. And or whatever we have that passes for such. So this elephant in this episode is the concept of psychokinesis, telekinesis. Why is all this weird moving around, right? That's the question that so many people have asked over the course of human civilization. While we have explored a few common causes or explanations for poltergeist, pranks by the living, often children, scrambled sensory processing in our brains, and the possibility of a still unproven entropic neural activity related to puberty, there is this one big, ghostly, spooky, Carrie-esque elephant. Things moving without physically touching them. This has been treated as a distinct type of research, one without the trappings of campfire tales and ghost stories and spooky stories to tell in the dark type approaches. There has been a ton of research into psychokinesis, and some of it is very easily dismissed. And there's some that's more interesting. In a future episode, I would love for us to dive deeper into the strange experiments at Duke University beginning in the 1930s. This is when the university opened an official parapsychology lab headed by one J.B. Rhine. J.B. Rhine may be familiar to some of us. He is the guy who literally coined the term parapsychology. So we're going to get into that later. And I think you're right. We have to get into Stevenson later. We may even get into specific, more robustly documented poltergeist cases later in the future if this is of interest to our fellow conspiracy realists. To bring it all back around, however, for our purposes today, we're not saying that strange things did not occur and later become recognized or called poltergeist cases. We're saying that the causes of these things were often misattributed. That part is inarguably true. We're also saying that as time went on, society began to shape the original stories to something that would fit their own larger or smaller narratives. And they became embellished with multiple retellings. They became increasingly compelling at the cost of becoming decreasingly factual. That's what happened, especially with the older ones in the 19th century when we're looking at, you know, the rise of spiritualism and so on. And, you know, poltergeist in the crowd, if you feel like we got it wrong, let us know.
Yeah.
Did you hear that?
Stop it.
I don't know what's going on.
You guys are a bunch of jerks.
Somebody's playing drums on my desk, underneath it.
Don't make me actually go play the actual drums to spook the poltergeist, because I'll do it.
Well, that skeleton behind me, Agent Scully, seems to keep creeping a little bit closer to the camera as we continue.
That's a good poltergeist flex. I like that. Yeah. Yes.
So that's it for us today. But we pass the otherworldly torch to you. Be it yours to hold it spookily high. What do you think about this? Could there be some sort of compelling, provable, reproducible cause for poltergeist activity? Could it be a mystery in the developing brain of a young adult? Could it be just a cultural lens through which we view weird things?
Yes.
Who knows? Well, we want to know what you think. So find us on social media. We are Conspiracy Stuff on Twitter and Facebook. On Instagram, we are Conspiracy Stuff Show. If you also go on Facebook, you can find our community page. It's called Here's Where It Gets Crazy. We highly recommend you check it out. Spend some time there. If you don't want to do that stuff, you can give us a call.
All you have to do is dial 1-833-STDWYTK. Let us know your story, and most importantly, let us know whether you are comfortable with it being used on the air, because we need to know. While we're on the subject of listeners, we do have to give a shout out to Victoria W. over on our Facebook page. You mentioned, Matt, Here's Where It Gets Crazy, just because they were they started a drinking game based on catchphrases we've used in the show. So I hope nobody gets alcohol poisoning. But also want to shout out all the people who have written in and decided to, in place of identifying one of the hosts to get onto that page, you have been telling us some jokes that are amazing. So shout out to Jordan S., who gives us the correct term for Pinterest users. Her husband calls them pin terrorist. And shout out to Gerald T., who says, here's my current favorite joke. Two windmills built close together were getting to know one another. What kind of music do you like? Asked one. The other replied, well, I've always been a big metal fan.
Wow. Sometimes wooden. Sometimes wooden. A lot of times wooden. But okay.
Anyway, so we are scribbled with that. But what if you don't like phones? What if you don't like social media or amazing memes and awesome jokes? There is still one way you can always contact us, regardless of the day of the week, the time, your position on poltergeist, whether you are or are not currently haunted. You can send us a good old-fashioned email where we are
conspiracy@iheartradio.com.
Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.